Oh, I didn't even hit. Here we go. Happy Monday, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Seattle Restaurant Podcast. Dave, how we doing, buddy?
Doing
I'm just going to jump right in there. It's a big week for you.
Yeah, it was a really good week.
What happened right after we got out of recording the podcast last week?
As soon as we walked outside.
A bird shit on your head.
No, but although that has happened. I looked down at my phone and I had lots and lots of notifications and realized that
finally got canceled.
Well, Kenji ate at Buckshot Honey the Sunday before the podcast, and I didn't see him do any recording because, I was kind of like, well, maybe he's just having a nice lunch with his daughter. Yeah. Monday we walked out, out of here, and he had posted his experience called Best Pacific Barbecue in the Northwest.
Right.
And he went through the Dave's Way sandwich, a bunch of sides, some pie, and there was an immediate Kenji effect.
Yeah. And what he was doing, he was recording with the Ray-Ban.
With his Meta glasses.
Yeah,
and that's why I didn't see anything, which I found super interesting. I hadn't seen video quality from glasses like that yet, and I was pretty impressed.
Yeah, no, I use them. I love them. So to describe the Kenji effect, how was this week? Did you feel it immediately, or?
So we opened, the video came out on Monday, and we're closed Mondays and Tuesdays. So Wednesday hit, and we ran 143% above our normal
fuck
numbers.
Fuck yeah, nice.
And Thursday trended a tad bit higher. Friday a little bit higher. Saturday pop. A lot of people talking about it.
Yeah.
Like, hey. Because I always ask people, I touch every table.
Yeah.
How you doing today? Yeah. Like, what are you getting into out here in these mountains? You know, oh, we're here because it's Kenji.
Fuck
video,
yeah.
And, you know, so we finished the week about 25-30% above normal.
Amazing. And how about social media?
Thanks, Kenji. Social media, we gained over 100 new followers, maybe 200.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably mid for a lot of his videos.
Yeah.
Some of his videos hit like 50,000.
Yeah.
I think we're running like 16,000 on TikTok.
Yeah.
10,000 on YouTube, a couple thousand on Instagram.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a fun experience.
Yeah.
I've never had anything like that happen or been tagged in something like that. And so it's all new to me, and it's been really fun and exciting.
Yeah. Cool. Before we introduce our guests, I just want to say the bear dinner, we have one ticket left. However, Meg from who was the guest last week said she's gonna buy it tonight. So I'm gonna call it a sellout. So I just wanna thank you, Seattle, for Damon was just in here. He's doing some recipe testing right now in my kitchen.
How many hot dogs is she giving you?
But I'm just blown away. We sold 40 tickets in the first day and 40 more in less than a week and or about a week. So thank you, Seattle. Now we just gotta concentrate on making the coolest event we can. So sorry if you didn't get tickets, but I try to warn you. All right, we got some fun people in here today. Over on my right, Chris, how we doing, brother?
Doing great.
Who are you? Introduce yourself.
Chris Nishiwaki, born and raised in Buenos Aires, Argentina, where I learned to cook Japanese food from my Japanese parents.
Nice.
And then moved to the States, where I learned to cook Argentinian food from my Japanese parents. That cultural connection was really important.
Yeah, for sure. And we've known each other for over a decade. I've seen you at events and stuff. What are some of the publications you write for?
So I'm a freelance writer. Locally, I write for Seattle Magazine. I also have written for Wine Business Monthly, which is the industry rag for the wine industry, and Food and Wine Magazine, Wine and Spirits, just about every publication around Seattle. Some who are no longer in business, unfortunately. And then also consult on TV shows, working on a film, a lot
of, you have your hands in a lot of things.
Yeah.
But mostly we want to talk about food. I'm sorry, how long have you been in Seattle?
Been in Seattle for over 30 years.
30
I came
years,
out here
yeah.
to go to school, to go to the University of Washington.
And then you just stuck around and
yeah, except
kept
for
on eating.
A year and a half, my first job out of college, I went to Kansas City to work for the Kansas City Star. Great newspaper, but I got homesick.
Yeah.
Living in Kansas City was miserable.
fair enough. Right on. And cool, we're going to talk about some of your fun food adventures in Seattle in the last 30 years. Over on my left, I have not been here yet, but everyone keeps on telling me. Aaron, how you doing, brother?
I'm doing very well, thank
what
you.
What is the name of your restaurant?
So I'm the chef owner of Sorrel.
over on 23rd and Madison.
Cool. And how long you been over there?
So I moved into that space. It would have been November 2nd of 2019. Scheduled to open up March 19th, 2020. And then this little thing happened that y'all might have heard about. But I've had Sorrel since 2016. Started as a pop-up restaurant. Ran that. Was doing pop-ups for about 5 years.
Where were you popping up?
So primarily in Ballard over at Merriam-Built Loft. Yeah. Taking over their space. Before that, over at the Bite Box when Sharon had that space in Queen Anne.
Yeah.
I was taking over that because they were just open for breakfast and lunch and was doing dinners there. And then also over in Bellevue at a little cooking school slash like retail shop called Whisk. They have a really awesome kitchen area that sat 16 guests for like a chef's counter kind of experience. So both those three spaces popped up the most at. There were a few others.
That's funny. Merriam-Built is the whole reason the whole Wu-Tang dinner thing started because
I have history there too.
Because like I went there and checked it out to do like a pop-up dinner and they were like, hey, we don't really book a lot of things here. If you want to like do 10 dinners or something like that, we'll give you a discount. And so I came up with like, I just wrote down like 30 different ideas. And one of them was Wu-Tang. And then like, thankfully it didn't happen there because like, that's what, how many seats is that? Like 30 or something?
Yeah, I think they have like two tables that seat 20 each and then like an 8-person chef's counter. If you use
yeah. So yeah. Thankfully I didn't do 36.
It's a cool building.
It's like beautiful. But what's your history with it?
Do you know Lisa Listener?
Yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, her her sister ran it for a minute, and she asked me to do some catering, so I did.
Sweet.
Yeah, that was kind of the same thing with me. We needed a space to do pop-ups, but also I did a lot of private dining catering back then, too. Yeah. So what I did basically was use it for both, and so they give me if I use it as my primary spot to bring my clients, then they would give me a big discount to do pop-ups. So I had a really symbiotic relationship with them, which is like what I encourage, like, everybody to do on that end, but it was great. Like the last all of 2019, I was pretty much only there because it sat 8 people, so it was like perfect for chef's counter. We do 2 seatings a night, worked really well.
And when you say that, was that called Sorrel back then?
Yeah,
and so that was always the concept.
Yeah,
what is the concept of Sorrel?
Yeah, so we're focused on modern Pacific Northwest cuisine, you know, and by that I mean that we work, you know, primarily with farms and ranches from within the area, just given that the Pacific Northwest, especially Washington, one of the most biodiverse places in the entire world, just really trying to showcase where we're at seasonally. So 80%+ of menus are just from where we're from. And then the other 20, you know, I love spices from around the world and things. Sure. So, you know, we're really transparent about the fact that we do offer certain things. And we even have certain things that we'll focus on a little bit from not from here, just as a speaking point about sustainability and ethical fishing and things like that, especially when it comes to seafood. But you know, by and large, really try and tell the story from where we're at. But, you know, my big thing is to also, like, have a place that is the most, hospitable, like, really focusing on what hospitality is and what I love, which is, like, to create the experience of a night for our guests, right, and not have it just be this kind of revolving door that restaurants can be sometimes, you know, really building community with the guests that come in. So we have a lot of returning guests. I feel really thankful for that because a lot of the times restaurants just, you know, it's like who's new and who can come in and whatnot. And we have a lot of people who come back because, you know, I think we make a real stride to getting people to feel good about dining with us and being inclusive, right? Because
what's the example of a certain aspect of hospitality that you're doing that you're saying, like, you know, not necessarily no one else is doing, but what makes you guys so special?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm, you know, just there's no new idea under the sun, right? So I'm not saying that we necessarily do anything truly unique to us. There are some things I think we do a little differently than other folks, but like, you know, when you come to join us, when you walk up, the first thing that you get is, you know, a hello and a little thank you beverage for coming to get you to kind of warm up to us. During the winter months, we have a really gorgeous patio space, so we use that kind of as a lounge and have guests kind of hang out there before we bring them to their table. But the other thing that we do that is, you know, that only a few other restaurants really do is just one seating a night.
Okay.
You know, and I think that that's, I think one of the big things in dining in general, especially in any form of fine dining that gets forgotten about is the luxury of time. You know, the one thing we can't refund is someone's time.
Sure.
And so we have to be really sensitive to that. And what does that mean? And how long should the dinner really be? And then also, like, not just that, but making sure that there's quality to that and making sure that we're touching the tables and having a very human moment to that, while at the same time, making sure that we're not overbearing and making sure that we're not, like, in the way all the time. So there's a lot of things that we do that traditional fine dining would, like, be very frowny on, like, what we do. But I just, like, through the pandemic and stuff, had my eyes really open to, like, what we were doing at the restaurant, to what like real needs of guests are. Mm-hmm. And it's not watering them every single time.
Right,
put
right.
a water bottle on the table, and stay out of their way.
Yeah, yeah.
They can pour because it's like the lowest hanging fruit of good service. Like you say, you always hear people say like, oh, they poured every single glass of water for me. Well, that's great. Did they make sure to like describe dishes to you, have a human experience with you? Did they seem to actually care that you had a good time? Right. Were they generous in spirit? Were they graceful in what they did? Did they, you know, present something in an interesting way? No, they watered me all the time. No, and I was, you know, I'm well hydrated. That's great.
I'm a,
but
I'm
like,
a plant.
They're also in your way all the time.
And it fucks up the conversation.
Yeah, yeah, totally. All night.
And remind, how many seats is Sorrel?
We have about 36, but we really only seat about 24 guests.
24 a night.
Yeah.
And what days are you open?
Wednesday through Saturday.
Cool. And what time does that start?
6:30.
And how long is this dinner?
About 2.5 to 3 hours wow. max. Yeah. And it just depends on what we're presenting. We also do a 4-course menu on just Wednesdays and Thursdays.
Okay.
Just as a way to be you know, as inclusive as we can towards people, you know. Not everyone wants to sit for 2.5 to 3 hours, so it's more of about an hour and a half.
So 4-course, and how many courses is the other one?
10.
And okay, cool. And what's the cost usually? Does it change per menu or?
No, it stays pretty consistent. The 4-course is 110, and the 10-course is 195.
What a deal. I know Chris is a fan of your wine program.
Yeah.
Chris, you've been to Sorrel?
I have not, but I've gone to the pop ups at Bite Box, what's now Bar Merriam, which is one of my favorite places.
Yeah, and you want to talk about his commitment to Washington wine.
Yeah, I mean that. I think that's fairly unique, which is surprising in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say a lot of things about the Washington wine industry, but the one of the things that I respect, like you were saying, the commitment to sourcing around here. There are enough choices. There's enough variety in Washington wine that if you don't want to, you don't really have to source imports. I tend to prefer wines from all over the world, including Washington, but there's definitely a market mm-hmm. for that here, unlike anywhere else, naturally.
Does Washington grow like pretty much every grape?
Yeah, so Washington is a really, I mean, there are definitely certain varietals that don't do well here. And, you know, one of, I think, the problems that Washington has had, one, being one of the younger growing regions, one of the younger, larger growing regions, especially in the United States, but we don't have, like, necessarily that one champion grape. You know, out of California, Napa Cabs, Chardonnay, Oregon, Southern Oregon, Willamette Valley, Pinot Noir, same goes with Northern California. So they've had kind of like a wagon to hitch themselves to that can really champion things. Washington, you know, though we definitely have, you know, those varietals, we do a lot of things really well. There are a lot of white wines that we are like so excited about seeing like where they go. Amos Rome, based out of Chelan, actually has 4 different Gruners that they do, which is like unheard of. You don't see a lot of that, but one grape that we wrestle with a lot, and not that it isn't drinkable, but we're not putting it, you'll rarely see it showcased in the way that you see out of Willamette Valley and Sonoma, is Pinot Noir. It just does not, it's a very temperamental plant that just doesn't like the growing region here. Now, I will say, I think we're pulling on a thread right now to Chelan, because there are a couple Pinot Noirs coming from there that I think we'll see how they develop. But I think there's a winery called Lagrioth and also Amos Rome. But Lagrioth, when I tried their Pinot Noir, it reminded me a lot of some of the Sonoma Pinot Noirs I had. And I was really excited about that. But I also believe in travel. You don't need to grow and have everything in one place. It's
right.
The reason to get you out
yeah.
from where you're at. So we do a lot of things really great. I'm a huge Syrah fan. So like Syrah, but, you know, Grenache, both red or white. We do really well in this state. There's a lot of whites. You know, we're known in this region for a lot of Rhone varietals and also a lot of Bordeaux style wines. And it's really amazing how they've been slept on here. You know, like we, you know, growing up, being in this industry in Seattle now for over 12 years here and in the industry overall for about 18, I've always found it really fascinating that no one has ever opened up an all Washington wine program. Not
right.
a single all Washington wine bar. You go down to California, Northern California, if you're in, especially if you're in Napa, but in Sonoma too, you can't turn around without seeing
right.
one. And so it's like, it would be like, you know, if you had a bunch of, it's to me, I always say this, like if you were to walk down the city streets of Seattle and see everybody wearing 49ers jerseys, right? There'd be riots in the street. Okay? And that's what it is with our wine programs. They're all rep in California way harder. And why? You know, they're like, oh, well, Napa Cabs. Well, I can show you probably almost a one-to-one of Washington wine to that. So that's a bad excuse. Now, if you're repping Pinot Noir, I get it. Like, I totally get that. But there's all these other things. And so why aren't you rooting for your home team? And it's this issue of a lot of different things. It's a distribution issue. It's a, you know, we essentially have like 25 to 30 purveyors, because in a lot of our lists we have to go direct, but I love having that relationship. And I think that there's a lot of power in that, because you're showing the community that you support them versus just like, you know, one of the different distribution houses, which I love those guys too. Like, I love being able to work with them, but you know, it's important for sustainability. It's important for, you know, the agriculture of where we live to invest in that. And, and you don't have to go whole hog like I did. Like, I understand that. It's just no one did. And I'm like, this is a great opportunity, because I believe that no one really cares where the wine comes from. They don't. What they care about is a great glass of wine. I mean, the vast majority of people, there's only a few people who are going to be that persnickety about like, oh, well, I only drink this, period. Like, they're like, you know, we don't need to be that particular. I think it's important to keep an open mind. But the thing is, once you start drinking some of the stuff here, it's wild how amazing it is. And also for us, like, you know, we do the deep dives. So there's the wineries that we have on our list are not going to be the ones that, if I asked you right now to name a winery from Washington, doubtful that they might be on our list, because those guys all take care of themselves. You know, we service a lot of wineries that are between 500 to 3,000 cases, which is, you know, small, 500 to, that's tiny, you know? And then we have some that definitely are closer to 10, but most of them are pretty small.
Did you get into drinking wine back in the day, Sid?
Ariana was a huge wine drinker.
You like, stuck with like Boone's Farm and Carlos Rossi.
I mean, I love like Mark Ryan was probably my favorite. I love doing events there. They have these big bold
I really got into red wines.
Okay, yeah.
I love the good Zinfandel.
You know what I got really into? Shiraz. Diet Coke and wine.
Oh. Are you joking?
No, that's my thing.
Really?
I drank for a different reason.
Some Laverne and Shirley shit.
You know what's funny? I've been to a lot of Seattle baseball games where I've seen more of the visiting team than home team jersey. Anyway.
That's not surprising at all.
I love going to Cardinals games here. So before the pop-ups, what's your story?
Grew up in northwestern Montana, right next to Glacier Park, a little town called Quorum, which is part of the Flathead Valley, Kalispell, Whitefish, Columbia Falls area. Really beautiful part of the country. Was there, lived in the same house all up until went to college, and then went to Missoula, to University of Montana. Was a music performance major. And through high school, like, I started working in restaurants at 14, because in Montana, the age to start working was pretty low. Same with driving. So, like, I had my learner's permit at 14 and a half, had a car by 15. Need to put gas in the car, so started washing dishes at a friend's restaurant, family friend's restaurant. Became a prep cook, then line cook, then was line cook and a server, because I saw the servers were making more money. So, and you know, minimum wage back then was $5.15. So, you know, doing both, would work in the morning as a line cook, would work at night as a server. Do that a lot, and all through high school, and then first bit of college, you know, worked in a couple restaurants and things. But then my sophomore year, got into a band, and then from pretty much 2003 through 2011 was really 2010 very serious in this band, toured the country. Wait, with
which
them
band?
It was a band called YDT. We were a kind of melodic hard rock band.
Oh, cool.
And it was a great way to spend my 20s. Touring the country. We'd play when we were in town, Numo's, Showbox. Love this city. And but it was a great way to see the country. And then our lead singer unfortunately broke his back and had to have an L5-S1 disc replacement. And I was starting to get pretty burnt out on that industry. And so started to, with those things kind of coming together, decided to start looking at some other options. I had my day job while I was in the band was actually working at FedEx. I worked in at FedEx, did sales there for a bit, but also worked in management. So that was like my day job. And they were actually really generous with giving me time off to tour, which was very surprising given they're such a big corporate office. But that gave me a lot of structural background. It's like I learned a lot about people management, about how to manage P&L statements, how to read P&L statements, like all these forecasting for a business, HR, like every little bit of that. And then band ended, went back to work for FedEx for a minute, and then kind of realized, like, you know, I've been kind of sleeping on working on restaurants. You know, back when I was 14, 16 years old, like, working in restaurants was not anywhere, you know, glamorous as it is today, though it's not, but it didn't have the cover fire.
I was going to say, man.
Cover fire. I mean, you know.
I'm a fucking diva.
Well, you know, you guys know how it is. And so back then it was just job. You know, it's like Anthony Bourdain, what did he say? Like something about it's a job you did when you got out of the army or before you went to prison, you know? And that was like the thing back in the day. And so anyways, so then 2009, 2010, started looking around, and by 11 got into, was like, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to go down and work with my uncle who'd been in the industry and fine dining, worked 42 years, amazing pastry chef. I was executive pastry chef and working between some restaurant groups down in Northern California. Went and worked with him for a week. I'm like, put me through the ringer.
Right.
If I can work baker's hours and work nights, like then, you know, that'll be a good test for me. Did that, loved it, of course. Came back, got into culinary school, and then within like, so I went to the Art Institute of Seattle while it was still here. Yep. Got really lucky because one of my instructors was Lauren Thompson, who's the now former, but was there for many years, chef de cuisine of Cafe Juanita, and now has moved on to working on a project, I believe, with Cafe Lago. But she was kind of a big mentor of mine, really helped point me in like where I should go work.
Right.
And so I ended up starting to be a private chef because a couple had inquired, and then I ended up working for them one day a week for like 8 years while working at restaurants 5 days a week and working on things on the side.
Did you always have to come up with like new menus and stuff? Like, was that like kind of a fun
every
way to
single
like
week. It was,
stay standard at the restaurant but be creative?
It was great because it gave me an opportunity to really practice my craft, but in a very safe environment that way. It was, could not have actually worked out better in many ways.
You ever fuck up anything? Like,
for them?
Yeah.
Man, I got to think about that. Yeah. I haven't really, you know, no, you know, the thing is when you, so I was a, you know, professional drummer for years, right? Yeah. Like you drop sticks, you break sticks while you're playing, right? Like you can't stop the song.
Yeah.
So you got to have another one right there to pick up. And it's never about, you know, missing the drum or missing the shot. It's about the rebound.
Yeah.
Right. And so like for me, like it was like learning that from a young age, like you got to just be on that rebound. Like don't even sweat the fact that you missed the shot, like, or that something burnt or something went wrong.
Right.
Plus, that is part of this. Like, you are going to mess up. Can I swear in here?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that fine? All right, just making sure. Because, like, you can, stuff's going to get fucked up. Like, and that's
successful
okay.
Successful recovery.
You know, the thing, yeah, man, it's like, it's okay. But, like, don't let that drag you down. It's like, you learn from it. Like, you know, figure out what your variables were. Like, was your, the temperature of what you were working with right? Did you mix it correctly? Like, yada, yada, yada. And get down to that so that you can actually understand. It's why, like, you know, I'm a nerd when it comes to knowing about how food works. So On Food and Cooking by Harold McGee was like my Bible for years. I've read that book like three times cover to cover. Because once you understand the science of like what's happening, and I'm not like, you know, those guys, Nathan at Modernist, some of those guys, they are crazy in their knowledge. But I refer to those books all the time to help, you know, and I did for years. Now I know a lot of it to help apply that so that we can control the environment and look at it a little scientifically to help with that. So anyways, culinary school, private chef. And then I started working at, one day a week at Lark.
Okay.
So like, you know, I had 6 years of experience as a short order cook and things, but like, you know, no one should be hired, especially a restaurant like that at the time. This is 2012. Beginning of 12, went and I just worked Friday. I'm like, if I work every Friday, I'm going to see a lot. I'm going to learn a lot. And so I just started working one day for free. And they didn't offer that to me. I offered that to them because I wasn't even familiar with staging yet.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't know that the
And
industry...
I'm sorry, what kind of, the place you staged at, what kind of place was that?
So, Lark. Yeah. So, you know, always, you know, they always teeter on that level of like casual, fine dining, casual. But really, you know, the thing about John is that his cuisine, especially during that time and for years, had been Pacific Northwest, so Pacific Northwest driven in what he was doing, along with some nice peppering in of techniques and things that I was familiar with and a lot of stuff that I wasn't familiar with. And so it was a really great opportunity to learn. It was also a kitchen, as I came to learn, that like you would either make it there or not. And it had nothing to do with how you were treated, because you were treated great. People were always really respectful there. It's just the workload. Like you had to be on it. So it made, you know, men out of boys real quick, you know, women out of girls. Like you were brought up because you had to be on it because of the, and you wanted to, because we respected John. He was, you know, can be a very, you know, quiet leader, but definitely someone with his respect of product and ingredient and technique, someone that you really wanted to follow, you know? And so I was super passionate about that place. I was there for about 3.5 years, left there as sous chef, was sous chef for about the last year and a half that I was there. Kind of grew through the ranks because I was lucky because Lauren, who is my instructor at culinary school, she had ping pong in her career between Lark and Cafe Juanita. going back and forth three times. And then she came on to be Chef de Cuisine at Lark.
Okay.
So then I got to work under her and John. And at time, we had some people leave the restaurant. And so the people who were working there at the time, Evan, who has Off Alley.
Yeah.
He and I were working together there. John Mix, who's Chef de Cuisine of Le Piché.
Yeah.
He was there with me. And so we had this pretty
What a fucking awesome, rock star team.
Oh, it was,
Jesus Christ.
It was an awesome crew.
That was like the 93 Dream Team.
Yeah, it was awesome. So like it was us and there wasn't really anyone else there. And then Evan ended up leaving. A couple new people came on, but it was a really small crew for a minute. Ben, who has Ben's Bread. Ben and I went to culinary school and then I helped convince him to come work for us at Lark.
Yeah.
And so at this moment, like it was John Mix, Ben Campbell, me, Mitch Mayers, who had Sawyer.
Yeah.
He was there Jesus. With us too. Mitch is a good friend. Like it was this baller team of us working together, but it was small. And then we ended up adding some more people on, but when you had both John and Lauren literally like over my shoulders before some of these other people came on, like I'm like, you know, I know everybody, the gray area is this, which is great. All of it's great. I want this.
Yeah.
Like I want to be scrutinized hard and make sure that I can get to the level that you need as fast as possible. And they were great about it. So like put me through that. And then, you know, being a little older than everybody else helped a lot too. Cause I was super like, you know, you guys all know how it is. People in their young 20s, need to socialize more to figure out what this life is about.
Yeah.
And so the rest, you know, work is a stop in between socializing, whether that's the bar or anything else.
Right.
For me, I was like, you know, I did a little of it, but I never drank a night before service. Like it was very down to business
very
because
yeah.
I needed to catch up.
Yeah.
Like these guys had all been working. And even if you're having a, you know, partying a good time, a lot of osmosis, you're going to remember and have all these things.
Right.
I didn't have that. So I needed to catch up. So for the time I was there, I was brass tacks, like working on things. But because I worked so much with the private chef work, with working there, and then after a couple months of working at Lark, they and Cafe Juanita had the same bookkeeper, and I was starting a stage at Cafe Juanita because I'm like, I'm not getting hired here, like I need a job, like I need somewhere. So I started working there, and this woman came around and was like asking somebody who was at Lark, like, who, you know, Holly wants to know who this Aaron guy is because she's debating on hiring him.
Yeah.
And John's like, can't have him.
Yeah.
And then I got hired the next day. So I ended up working, like I said, worked there, helped them move into the new space they're at, and then ended up leaving there, and then helped do some consult work around town, opened up a couple places, worked on a few kind of fun projects that I'd never kind of worked on before, which were great. And then spent a month in California in San Francisco working with two Michelin star restaurant called Qua. That's no longer around. They were a casualty of the pandemic, but really amazing spot. Daniel Patterson's restaurant, worked with them. And then came back to the city, worked with Canlis for the year 16 as kind of a, to prove a business theory, correct that, I had, which was that any form of private dining can help set like the financial future of a restaurant free in a lot of ways, because I saw that they were like, I felt like printing money upstairs. Mm-hmm. Like while I was there, we were doing, you know, sometimes as many as 5, if not 7 events in a week. Like almost every night there was something happening.
So these were like the starting steps of Sorrel.
So to rewind, in 13 I started doing my first pop-ups.
Okay.
So I got asked by a friend if I would do these winemakers dinners at this wine cellar out in Issaquah, and they were themed. One was Spanish, one was French, one was Italian. Then the next one was with Covington Cellars / Two Vintners with Morgan Lee, who's a local winemaker and incredibly talented. worked with him, then Chris Sparkman of Sparkman Cellars, then Darby English of Darby Winery. And then I was like, what's going on with these Washington wines? And that's kind of what first lit the fuse to my Washington Wine Love while I'm working on everything else. Doing these pop-ups, trying to figure out like where I want my cuisine to go and what that even means.
Right.
But very, very early on, beginning of 16, I started to have a much better idea of that. But I needed to round out some of the, like, seeing what was working in fine dining. And Canlis being the institution that it is, was a really great place to see how they're running things. Because, you know, that matters. You can't just do whatever you want. It's a big mistake that a lot of people make. Like a lot of times, like you guys know, you put a restaurant in a certain community, but if you're a walk-up place and you're doing something that no one likes or that not enough people like, you got to start to evolve a little bit. And you can still have some of your cake and eat it too, but you got to be reasonable with that.
Right.
Like, you know, if you try to shoehorn yourself into where whatever it is, we've seen those restaurants come and go many, many times. And so anyways, I was watching what they were doing there to see how they were doing it. Huge operation, ton of respect for like how they have developed. And I know, you know, people have mixed feelings that go up and down and left and right and all over the place.
But it's still an institution.
It is. Yeah. And the thing about it is that the family, it's amazing to have a restaurant open that long and to do what they do. Like, it's just, it's unheard of. But for me, I wanted something much smaller than that. Right. Like, I had no aspirations. Went to Japan in November of 16 and had a meal at a place called Bar Yasuda. That's an eight-person counter with a four-top.
Okay.
It's only the chef, his wife, and a hostess there.
Oh, cool.
And kind of was like, okay, this idea of a 40-seat restaurant that I thought I wanted, I don't want that anymore. Yeah. Like, I want much smaller.
Right.
And I'd been looking at spaces, started looking at spaces in 17, tried to figure things out. And meanwhile, doing all these pop-ups, because at beginning of 17 was off on my own altogether. Right. Like, kind of like ended my year with Canlis, and I'm like, it's time for me to just go on my own. Because at that point, I could only work for them 4 days a week. I was just way too busy with pop-ups, private dining, catering, and things. And I had built up enough of a client base that I could support myself. So I was like, okay, time to move on to the next thing. I started just running Sorrel, met my wife. My to-be wife, January 5th of 17. So 17 was a really good year. 33 was an excellent year for me personally. And so really started working at it. But, you know, I was really comfortable with doing just pop-ups.
Right.
You know, like I really saw, and this is a benefit of being older, is maybe understanding our own mortality in some ways. But that's in business too, that like, you know, I had friends who were opening up restaurants sinking like $1.6 million into them.
Right.
What? Like, I don't want to be liable for that. And so I had to do some discovery to find out, like, how can we, like, bring that way down? And so I was looking at spaces that were former restaurants. I just kept on having disputes with, like, the landlords. Like, they just – I'm like, we're not going to get along. And if I have any problems with this space, like, it's going to bite me in the ass later. So I need to move on and look for a better relationship and just be okay with, like, I had this great commissary kitchen out of West Seattle on Del Ridge. Had a great situation with that. Was liking the schedule I had, but I started, like, having months that would go by, and this really started in, like, late 18 to 19, where I was spending anywhere from about $10,000 to $11,000 up to $20,000 a month in renting other people's spaces for private events.
Yep.
And not including the pop-up too, but like both. And I'm like, okay, I need to find a space that's my own, because I can pocket that money. Like, that is just going to be something that I keep for myself and help build this business. So started looking for space, kept on looking for spaces, but just I ended up looking at 7 different spaces. I almost went into a spot in Fremont. And I was really excited about it, but then it kept on getting misquoted by contractors. It went from a $250,000 project to a $350,000 to a $5,000. The fourth contractor quoted it at $750,000. And I like had to talk to the builder, the guy who owned the building, just about, hey, I got a, you know, TI allowance for the space. Best I can do is like split it.
Right.
Like, you know, and so we're about to do that, but then I like had a sobering moment. That's too much money.
Yeah.
Like, it's too much. And then at the same time, I was about to get married, October 12th. My landlords approached me, my now landlords approached me 2 weeks prior to that and say, hey, we have this space. I'm like, where is it? Like 2319 East Madison. I'm like, oh, that's old Crush space.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I'd love to come take a look at it. Came in, take a look at it. I was like, this is amazing. Went over my business plan with them. They loved it. And then came back on the 11th, the morning of the 11th, the day of my rehearsal dinner for my wedding. Signed the lease, went, got married, came back from honeymoon, got right to work on the business. November 2nd, had keys in hand to start working on it. And then the original plan was to open it up, do the tasting menu 1 day a week, just Thursdays, as a selfish thing for me, for creativity's sake. But run it 4 days a week as a Washington wine bar, and then use it as a space for private events for the private dining catering company, and had it very built like that. Then go to open up March 19th, our goal. But then beginning of March, there's an avalanche.
Yep.
And
Aaron, I'm gonna pause you right please. There. It's fascinating, but I want to make sure I get to Chris because he had some fun. So we're gonna talk about the launch of the restaurant in a second. Chris, sorry,
yes, brother. Sir.
Taste of Washington. What you said you want to talk about that? What's your opinion about Taste of Washington right now?
You know, it's constantly reinventing themselves, so it's always a different experience. I've been going to Taste Washington since it was at the Paramount. I don't know if you all remember.
Yep.
Tiny. Wait, what month did they do it now?
It's happening this week.
Oh, actually. Shit.
Yeah.
But so it's Washington Wine Month. There's two Washington Wine Months. There's another one, August, I would say?
Yeah.
This is a 3-4 day affair. 5 days, yeah, really. If you count the Monday,
I haven't been there in a while, but
I haven't been invited.
I remember doing a stage demo.
Was that really well done?
It was fun.
I don't know what your experience has been there with the production company there, but they set you up really well, and it's just one more thing, one more activity for the guests there to enjoy. It's wine. It's not just for wine's sake. Mm-hmm. It's important to integrate the food. So this is why someone like Aaron doing what he's doing is really important for Washington wine to be sustainable. I think it's important to incorporate the two. The other thing that's important, I think, in wine and promoting wine and selling wine is there's so much out there. It's so confusing. It makes a big difference when the wine consumer has a connection.
Right.
Whatever that connection may be, you know, they go to Sorrel, they go to a tasting room, and the tasting room attendant takes care of them. They walk the vineyard by themselves. If that's a connection, and that makes wine that much more relatable because it's so confusing, that makes a huge difference. Taste Washington is one of those opportunities, you know, one of those rare opportunities once a year where you can meet the winemaker and you can have that connection. You can't, and you know, their consumers is like, yeah, I know the winemaker, blah, blah, blah. And, but the winemaker doesn't know you.
Right.
But
do you remember
it's that connection.
Do you remember those Voracious?
Yeah.
I wish stuff like that would come back.
Yeah, I used to
working work, on it.
Yeah. for the weekly when
yeah,
they
I thought
started.
So. That's why I wanted to ask you about it.
It was a similar farm. It was at the Paramount.
Yeah, it was super fun.
Yeah.
Oh, we got hammered at that one. That was a fun one.
Yes, Sid, we did.
I remember one time liquor rep. There was like a liquor booth next to Skillet, and they never showed up. But all their bottles were under the table.
Oh, we're just sitting there unattended.
Yeah. Yep. And we and then I remember.
Somehow they were just absorbed into our booth.
Yeah, they never showed up. What are some of your other favorite events? I don't know if you know, Chris. Like, we're working on a Seattle Restaurant Podcast Festival, and actually a big meeting tomorrow that hopefully will solidify some stuff. But what are some of your? Well, let me start with this. I got a lot of beef with the Costco style, like just shove food in your mouth, like don't meet the maker, like stuff like that. And that's my reason for starting a festival, because mine's gonna be much more immersive and restaurant focused. But what are some of your favorite events around Seattle? I want to talk about the good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, also a lot of my education in food and restaurants has been through benefit events. So Auction and Washington Wines, they do a spectacular
excellent
job there
event.
Too.
Yeah,
so great they event. Four days worth of it. In fact, actually this week they spread it out over the year too. So they have a barrel auction this week related to that. There are any number of other benefit events, but man, there's so many great events out there these days for every interest in tasting food.
Have you ever been a Burning Beast?
I have. Tamara Murphy's one of my favorite people in the whole industry.
Same.
Yeah. And what she's done, she does a lot of work, a lot of mentoring behind the scenes that nobody ever hears about.
Yeah.
And
definitely witnessed it. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. It's not really...
Yeah, Burning Beast, that's another weekend's worth of experience.
Yes, which weekend, man?
I don't know. Yeah, Tamara.
I got
to
mark it in my calendar.
I feel like I heard something about August, but like I don't know. But
She's moving to West Seattle. She just bought a house in West Seattle. She's moving. She's busy with that.
I saw that, yeah.
She's been wanting to open that second place in Columbia City. Yeah. So look for that.
Cool. Apparently she's busy.
Yeah. to do a charity event. All right.
Get this. Holly Smith was her sous chef when she opened Brazza.
Oh, really?
Can you imagine that, both that talent in the kitchen? There were Holly Smith, Ashley Merriman.
Brazza.
A lot of good people.
Well, I mean, way back in the day, original Dahlia, you know, John and Holly hired 6 months, John from Lark, Holly from Cafe Wainey, 6 months apart from each other, but were there together, and their family trees are crazy in this city. Like, and no, I mean, that was a long time ago at this point, but like.
Philip Mahalski was there at the same time. Dusky Estes, who's now in Sonoma. What's his name? He's up in Langley.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They were all Costello, all kinds of talent. And, you know, to Tom's credit and to Eric Tanaka's credit, they train them and then they go off.
That's a serious kitchen back in the day.
Yeah. And the other thing, also to Tom and Jackie's credit, is not just what happens in the kitchen, but building a business and, you know, reading the lease, all that. All that fun stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just want to comment on the events. You know, we need to get back to more in Seattle to help grow the community. It's something that I talk with people about regularly. I was just talking. I was at this dinner last Tuesday that was a bunch of people from the industry, mainly chefs, that were invited for this product tasting, this Japanese sustainable seafood. And it was really interesting. But I was talking to a few people, Miranda from Musang and a couple others, just about, like, we need more stuff that brings us together.
Yep.
We used to have more of that pre-pandemic.
Yep.
And I think that, like, you know, it's hard. I mean, you guys know how it is. Like, we got to scramble to keep things going. And I think a lot of people, even though it's been a couple years since things were really dire, those aftershocks are still, and everyone's just running. Like, we got to just keep on the
catch
pace.
Up. Yeah.
But we need to get back to some more of that, because it helps enrich the reason why we love this industry. Like, one of my favorite events annually was Wild About Game down in outside of Portland that Nikki USA would put on. And they haven't got back to it yet for a lot of different reasons. And they've, I think, changed a little bit of their business focus just due to the pandemic and a lot. But we need more of those things that are more internally focused industry. And then that brings in, because then the general public
Brings in the community.
Yeah. And well, tell you what, Aaron, hopefully I have a really good meeting tomorrow. I'll give you a call soon and invite you to something for, you know, a year from now. And and we can do something really cool. So wanna let's before we get into restaurants that we like and have eaten at this week, I want to finish the story of the opening. So you got the Crush. By the way, side note, Crush, probably top three dining experience of my life.
That's awesome.
I fucking loved that place. Had some homies that worked there. Kind of, you know, when I was in California, I staged at, like, Michelin star restaurants, but, like, I couldn't afford to eat at them. And then when I moved here, my friends that worked there would take care of me, because I was still working on, you know, the skillet, the skillet wage. So, you know, and they'd take care of me, and it was like watching a movie. It was a quiet kitchen, like, you know, come, because, and, you know, my buddy that worked there, Scotty, he also would help us at Skillet. So, like, he'd flip burgers real loud and shit, and then I'd see a completely different person, just so fucking quiet, producing the best fucking looking and tasting food ever had. Anyway, sorry. So you got the Crush building, and then how'd it go from there?
Yeah, so then, you know, pandemic hits. My wife, we do a little to-go food, but then close down like everybody else, because, you know, we were all told the whole 2 weeks things. We're like, all right, fine. At home, losing my mind, because being at home is just not an easy thing for me. I need to be active. Wife made a backpack of margaritas, and we walked around to Alki and grieved the situation. Took a day or two to recover from that, and then got on to what the next thing was going to be. And then I got really fortunate. I had a call from organizers working with Jose Andreas from World Central Kitchen to start doing meals to healthcare workers and the homeless. And we did that for about 4.5 months, and that was really amazing work that gave us such a sense of purpose during that, you know, end of March through July kind of time period when things were just wild. I mean, it is hard to reimagine, like, or to, like, even think of a situation with the amount of social insanities that were going on at the time, and then also COVID just being out of control and knowing anything about it. It was a really wild period. And so we worked with them, and it was just great work that made us feel so great. I mean, we have a tiny kitchen. We were doing about 1,500 to 1,700 meals a week out of this little kitchen between three of us. That included my wife, who was a delivery driver, who was stepping out of her industry for a minute to help. So we did that. And then they took their efforts out of town to help with hurricane relief in Puerto Rico. And when they did that, we started serving a menu on our patio. But just it was two tables.
Yep.
It was two tables. It was just myself, my wife. And at that time, John Mix, who's Chef de Cuisine Cafe, or of Le Pichet, was my sous chef at the time. Cool. He could only work about a day and a half a week because of childcare constraints. Right. And so we did that. And we would be open Thursday, Friday, Saturday. We would do 2 to 3 seatings a day of just these two tables. And we made that work. We did that for about a year. We did all outdoor service. We never brought it inside because the inside we had converted into a production kitchen. So the dining rooms in there, we had Metro racks. We had stainless steel tables. Peterson's Rentals loaned us for free 6 refrigerators to use to help serve everybody. So while at that time we had that, but the dining room was not fit. Meanwhile, my wife and I, who had just got married just 6 months ago, are like trying to get pregnant. And if you guys all don't know, the three worst things for a guy's fertility are stress, coffee, and alcohol. In 2020, there was an abundance of all three. And so, you know, so anyways, we segregated service, and it was amazing. The patio there is a really special thing. And I had kind of thought about developing, but, you know, what is the saying? You know, necessity is the mother of invention. And so needed to create this special dining space, and we put a lot of effort into it. It's now a really incredible spot that I'm so proud of. Yeah. And we look forward to every single season, like opening it up. But we started with a tasting menu. I'd built a pretty strong newsletter while I was doing the pop-up. So we were able to like send that out and tell people like, come, you know, and check out what we're doing. We were doing this distance dining concept where you would have your table and then a table about 3 feet from that table. And we'd place your plates there and ask you the friendly favor, bring them the last few feet to you. Mm-hmm. That was so that you didn't get interrupted in your experience taking a sip of wine by us asking you to put a mask on or a bite of food, right? Because that's like the best part of dining is like enjoying that. But to have that interrupted was just terrible. And this is, to go back to what I was saying earlier, like what helped inform my new beliefs, what would become my new beliefs in what full service and what great hospitality actually are. So we did that. And then over the summer 2021, as we were all getting vaccinated, started hiring staff. And by late summer to early fall, had a full staff, and then had our actual grand opening November 2nd of 2021. But the business model had changed. You know, we couldn't do private dining and catering, which had I had done very well with financially, like trying to do more business. We had had to go become a restaurant, which I had never planned to do. And so we opened up 4 days a week, Wednesday through Saturday, and doing at that point we were doing a 9-course tasting menu, and that's where things we really started digging into that. I have had a really amazing team working with me then, and it's just evolved. But over that last what has now been two and a half years at this point, I've been really fortunate to have some amazing people to come and work with me, and someone who worked as my creative director for a while, helping me because we were just great at bouncing ideas off of each other. Design an experience for guests to where like they can have some fun and relax and have a great time and go through this journey of dishes and things, but also have it be something that's like warm and not a starchy experience in any way that fine dining can so often be, and discover that. And you know, meanwhile, you know, Will Gadara, who had run and owned 11 Madison Park, came out with Unreasonable Hospitality. Yep. And it was like all these ideas that I had floating around were like turned into a book. And and it was so great to feel like understood, because like so many of us like want to give a better experience to our staff and want to give a better experience to our guests, no matter what part of the industry we're in.
Sure.
But it's like how, and to have somebody who like put out a book that has so much of that thought.
The manual.
Well, yeah, man. I mean, I think in a lot of ways. I mean, for me, like, I want cooks to make more money.
Yeah.
Right. And everyone says that. And I know that they mean that, but it's like, how? Right. That money just doesn't come from anywhere. And what you end up doing is stealing money from one pot and then giving it to your cooks. And that's great. But what I think is that cooks need to have a little bit of flexibility in some of their to-dos. And if you have a good person in management, they can rotate through, and we can get rid of people, because there are busters who make more than line cooks sometimes, right?
Yeah, 100%.
That's a job that any line cook in this world can do, right? Mm-hmm. And so if cooks are, if you have somebody who works like as a kitchen server, you know, certain days of the week, and maybe they help with final garnishing, and then they help run plates, and they help clear plates, and then they maybe even mark guests here and there, and that's part of like at least one to maybe a few days a week.
So it's cross-training everyone.
Yeah, cross, and that's what we do. So we're like a big Venn diagram.
Yeah.
And we don't have a dishwasher.
Yep.
So we have three dishwashing stations. We have one on the main level. We have one upstairs for all of our glassware. We have three compartment sink in the basement.
Fucking basement.
But yeah, the basement there as well. But we end up splitting that work between all of us. And so, you know, kind of thing is like everybody, at least if they run a rack or two of plates a night, you know, if you ever work service, you know, you work behind a bar, you have done all your own glassware and stemware and flatware many times in your life. So like, that's not new for service. So they're all, they shrug their shoulders way more than cooks do. They're okay, whatever.
No big deal.
Racks, plates, whatever. Cooks, like, they're like, okay. But then once they see how it works, it makes complete sense, because we only doing that one seating really allows for us to do that.
Have a system.
I think that if we were like a la carte and we would have to, the management of that would have to be different. It's much easier to manage it when it's just one seating. But I still think that there could be components of that, because, I mean, there isn't a restaurant anywhere that isn't looking for a dishwasher or at least wants a backup dishwasher, right? And so it's like, being such an Achilles heel, we need a better way of managing that. Yeah. And you know, there could be a lot of ways to look at that. And, you know, as I like to say, conversations to have over beers, because we can get way in the weeds on it. But with cooks, like, I'm really proud of what we're able to pay people. And that's stealing from other pots. They're just taking over jobs that you would normally hire service people for.
I love that way of thinking. Okay, before we get out of here real quick, Chris, you've been here for a while. You've eaten a lot of places. I've seen you, like, you, I don't know, you're almost like a Where's Waldo for me of like every event and restaurant, because you always just pop out of the ground and say hi. What are some of your favorite dining experiences in Seattle?
There's a whole bunch. The one of the things that we had touched on in one of our previous conversations, there's this terrible habit for food writers to just write about new restaurants, and that's all they do. So a lot of the classics are forgotten. So I become that old man. Oh, the way things used to be.
That's great.
Monsoon's been around for almost 30 years, 20 some odd years.
Eric and Sophie.
Yeah.
Yeah, I worked from them back in my early days.
Yeah, Eric will make you work.
Yeah, man.
Café Campania, which is Le Pichet adjacent, if you will. Same thing, Daisley Gordon, absolutely brilliant, consistent. I always appreciate places like that. One of my favorite things to do is just to walk around the International District.
Love
barbecue.
Cow.
Right? Get that to go, walk around the International District.
Real quick, sorry to cut you off. I've had this conversation this week where I'm like, I haven't been to down there in a minute, and I want to do something where I can like get stoned, walk around, and eat a bunch of stuff. What is your path? I think you were just saying before.
Cow Cow is usually a pretty good place to start.
Sure.
Or Awajimaya is always fun.
Totally.
Park there, they validate, do a little shopping, and then keep going. Tai Tong is spectacular too.
What do you get there?
Beef and oyster sauce.
Yeah. Oh, the old Bruce Lee classic.
Yeah, cliche, I guess. It's Seattle cliche, but man.
Does Chef Morimoto still have a place down there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been there. That's
pretty solid ramen place.
Nice.
But there's an even better ramen place. It's a truck cart that sets up at Figurehead and Obeck.
Okay.
Midnight Ramen.
Yeah.
They're supposed to have, I don't know, I haven't checked recently, but they're supposed to have a permanent bricks and mortar and on Stone Way somewhere.
Okay.
Cool. It's called Midnight Ramen.
Midnight Ramen.
So we got the pork from Cow Cow, the oyster sauce beef, from what was the name again?
Din Tai Fung.
Yeah. Tai Tong.
Tai Tong. Yeah. And then?
Oh, there are a bunch of other places.
What's for dessert? Where's the like quick pop in, get dessert?
Oh, yeah, there's a couple bakeries down there.
Yeah. What's the bakery? You've
been to Hood Canal?
Yeah. The Filipino bakery that's, and I can't remember the name, but it's run by the wife and husband team, but the husband's he's the DJ. Why can't I remember his name?
This happened last week.
It'll come to me.
Okay, cool. Real quick.
This happens when you get old.
Yeah.
Forget stuff.
Or stoned.
So. So I ate a ton of places. I want to run through this real quick. Had some old standbys. Went to Watson's and got the Deuces and Dreamland because I'm in there a ton just researching, planning for the Bear. I'm so excited right now because Damond and Denali are upstairs and cooking.
Oh, Denali's in the house
too? Yeah, so they're doing some recipe testing. So I cannot wait to go upstairs and try some delicious food. Okay, so two places I want to talk about pretty hard. Went to Anchovies and Salt in Renton.
Was that the one that the Portland?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
You invited me.
Okay,
I'm
so
sorry,
so first of all, the owner's coming on the 25th, I believe. So in a couple of weeks. So we'll dive into the menu then because we don't have a ton of time.
Okay.
All I want to say is I will preface with that he invited me out and he ended up copying my meal. So I just want to say that so there's no weirdness, whatever. He said, "Hey, I'm coming on the podcast. I want you to come experience it so we can talk about it." The most I knew about is one Chef Francis is a chef there. He worked at with Denali at the Frog, and he's done a lot of the Pop Pop events. So I knew he was a chef there. And the other thing I knew was they got a lot of fucking hate on Instagram. A lot of people saying like it's overpriced. I don't understand why rice is $5. Blah blah blah. Blah. That's also during the soft opening.
We've touched on that.
And now I'm a little bit madder about it because the owner he first we had a fantastic meal that we're gonna talk about when he comes on, but what he did was it's the biggest Vietnamese restaurant outside of Vietnam. I think it's like 441 seats.
I read that when all that was going on.
Now here's where it gets crazy. So like you have all this hate of like the price whatever. This he did construction for 17 years. It's all his design. It's all like, and what it is, each room is a different region of Vietnam. It is so thought out. The way, like, not to make it about me, but you know, like we put so much thought into these pop-up dinners for one night. This dude has put, you know, 70
multiple
like, year, like each pillar has like a little painting of one of his family's like zodiac. There's a bunch of hidden stuff. And he walked me through the whole restaurant, took time. I'm a fucking asshole. He invites me out on Saturday morning. He says, "Hey, come out when you can." And I look at my calendar. I'm busy every day except that Saturday night. So I go there at 7:30 on Saturday night.
Yeah, I was wondering why you invited me to dinner on a Saturday night.
Because I'm an asshole. That's why. And I didn't even think
about
it.
What are you doing tonight?
I was in service because I was doing service that morning at Columbus City Farmers Market. And I was like, oh, I'm free tonight. And like I didn't think of it. But anyway, he took time. I was busy Saturday night. Packed house of 400 people.
Did they seat 400?
No, he'll talk about me. It's not that. Okay. Beautiful restaurant and so much thought out to it. And honestly, like, what month is it? Well, I would say like last in one calendar year, it's probably top five dining experiences.
Wow.
Like, and I'm just saying that because I got a comp meal. I'm not saying that because Francis works there, Chef Francis works there. It like the amount of thought and love and care that went into the dish and the build out. Like, just gives me a boner. Like, honestly, that's not the name of the podcast. But anyway, so fantastic. Can I recommend it enough?
Are they open 7 days a week?
They are.
All right, cool.
It's a drive. It's in Renton. And it's a weird, isn't a weird place, man. It's like a half hotel, half living space in Renton.
Love it.
I'm not saying weird for, it's like Bellevue weird. Like anyway.
Even creepier.
Other place, Sofon and Finney, sister restaurant of Oliver's Twist. Fucking really dope menu. Highly recommend for vegans and vegetarians. You know, I don't love vegetables. However, I did really enjoy their menu. My favorite dish was they had a chicken karaage and then they had a mushroom one, and that was really good with oyster mushrooms. But like, tons of vegetables, a really great steak, wonderful people, and our server happened to also do. She's from San Francisco and she does a pop up. I'm gonna look it up before the end of the thing, but she's gonna be at a festival I'm doing, so it's kind of fun.
Kind of a little networking as well.
I feel like I didn't give that good enough pitch. Go to Sofon, fucking really dope. It's gonna be a really cool like neighborhood spot. The prices are very, very fair. And me, Ono, and my buddy from Ryan, he was the sous chef at Brent Circuses. He's now over at Beast and Cleaver. And my buddy Greg, we all ate the whole menu. We just ordered the whole menu, and it's four of us. And it was like, when we split it, it was really reasonable.
And that's the one that Meg was really.
We went. And then I also want to mention, I'm not going to pronounce it right because I have the worst handwriting, but when I was at Columbia City, there's a donut truck called Ninth and Henniper. And this is an interesting story. So, he had a line right out the gate. Like, I guess he does a pop-up in covered places. He's big on Instagram. But he does a $3 donut. And then they come in like really nice to-go boxes. And I was like, bro, what the fuck are you doing? Like a three, like he's frying them there and they're all like, you know, like fancy donuts. I would say top three donut I ever have had in my life. I feel like I said that a lot today. But
I'm a big donut guy.
I'm telling you gotta try them. They're fantastic. I've had most of like the fancy upscale donuts in Seattle, and this is fucking, he's doing it. And I guess he's been like a big chef. His name's Justin, but he was a chef for a while, ran a bunch of stuff, and like this is his happy place. But here's a point I want to make, and I'd love to get your quick opinions about it before we ask Dave about where he ate and we do plugs. But he did a $3 donut, and I'm like, how does this work? Is it volume? Like, what? And he definitely does volume, but like,
do you think that's a lot?
I think that's fucking cheap. I think these are $6 donuts, like. For sure. Like,
I just was wondering which side.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. Like, well, you know, I'm always going to champion to charge for more, but like, I'm like, this is 100% a $6 donut. Like, huge, beautiful, great, like, weird, cool ingredients from the farmer's market, whatever. And he was just like, you know, my rent's $1,000. Like, I don't have kids. Like, I'm happy. And it was this interesting thing where I countered with like, well, my rent is $4,300. I have three kids. My daycare is $1,300 a month. Like, that's why I charge $17 for my dish. And I don't know, it kind of brings up, like, when you have these one-man operations, do you think it's a fair thing to do to price for your living expenses versus not your food cost? Because that's how I charge.
That's an interesting question, because I've never really thought about, like, all right, this is what I spend a month personally, so this is what I'm going to charge per dish. I'm more of, like, this is what the dish costs, and this is a fair markup.
And you hope you make enough at the end of the
month.
And I can't do that when I have three kids to take care of. Like, I got to charge my – so that's the answer. If your question is why is your dish $17, it's because I'm paying $4,300 on rent.
Maybe that's evolution.
Did you eat anywhere this week?
I went to just my, favorite place in the world, Star Brass, and had a double tavern burger on the way back from, checking out brisket and stuff over at Preservation Meats. And then I just hit out, I think I stopped by South Fork too, just my regular stops, throughout a busy week. I was, just kind of gearing up. It was hard to predict what my week was going to be like after the Kinji video. And so I was just really head in the game, trying to stay focused and be as organized as possible. I don't ever want success to catch me off guard. I want to be poised and ready.
So
that's kind of where my head was at all week.
And then my asshole self goes, hey, you want to go out to dinner on Saturday night on your busiest week?
Yeah, totally my busiest day. Yeah. What time, Sid? He's like 7.
I'm already done with work. I made my money for the day. Yeah. All right, Aaron, I'm sure you have 1,000 places to talk about, but can you talk about some of your favorite places or places you've been recently?
Yeah, so
I know you have a crazy schedule. So probably don't eat a ton.
Well, the one thing is we're open those 4 days a week. We're closed Sunday, Monday, and then Tuesday's production, closed door production. So, my wife and I have been making bigger efforts to get out. The first place I was going to mention in the ID that we found, which is a hot pot place, and I've been – I went, 3 times in, 10 days. Is called Chengdu Memory. And, place freaking delicious, but they get it. You walk in, they have snacks, they have all this stuff for free. They have a body spray on the way out because you're gonna smell like soup. They have aprons, they have covers for your
Say, say it again because I think I have the name of the podcast. What happens when you walk out?
They have this body spray that you can hit yourself with,
and it smells like soup.
Well, no, it doesn't smell like soup. That's the
point.
You
don't smell like soup.
Yeah,
I am no longer interested in going to this place at all.
So there, and then I got a call out. We went on Thursday. We went every single Thursday for 6 months because it's where we had our first date. New Luck Toy.
Of course.
West Hill. My boy, Brandon, who is bar manager there, he helped me propose to my wife with this secret thing that I did.
Cute.
Let's
not gloss over that.
But I will tell you that place, I've been there through many different people who've worked in that kitchen, and the food's always been good. And any place that's been around, especially when they have the same menu, it'll be a roller coaster, and it's always good, but there's great, and then there's it's good.
Yeah.
We went on Thursday, and it was amazing. It was just little things, right? Yeah. Things were just a little more crisp, a little more acidic when they should be. Just the flavors were not muddled in it. I mean, they crushed it, and they were super busy. So it's just that kitchen's on. Other than that, my wife is an amazing cook. I don't eat out a ton, but we're working on it. We have a year and a half old baby, and that's really what's put a wrench in going out. But my mom's an amazing grandma and babysitter, so we're working on a bit more of that. Had a great meal months back at Driftwood. Excited to see what's going to happen with those guys because being on Alki and being a former Alki resident, we're just around the corner now and still in West Seattle. I'm excited to have a place like that in West Seattle. And then, my guys over at Shadowland, I would appreciate the work that they're doing.
I don't know anything about Shadowland. Shadowland
is a great bar in West Seattle, and I always encourage people to go because they have a late night menu that they serve till 1.
What kind of food?
Bunch of different bar food, burgers and sandwiches and stuff, but it's all done well.
Yeah.
And it's just it's a great little community there, and I always give them a shout out anytime I'm anywhere just because we need more places like that. Seattle shuts down so early every night. There's a lot of us industry wise that need at least just a burger and a beer or something somewhere. And even that seems to be consolidated. I mean, I remember the days when Babar was open till 4 a.m. and you could get food till 2 a.m. on a Friday or Saturday night.
Oh, yeah, Babar with that.
Yeah.
Duck confit.
Yeah.
Right on. Dave, before we get out of here, any plugs you want to talk about? You just recovering from the Kenji ass rape? Is that what it's called? The Kenji ass rape? No.
Kenji effect.
Oh, Kenji effect. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this week is going – it looks pretty promising. It's supposed to be super sunny and in the mid to high 60s. So I'm sure a lot of people are coming out to the mountains and just kind of prepare for that. I'm pretty staffed up, and I'm making some moves to elevate my staff and get people just super trained up for the summertime so I can spend more time out by the grill and the smoker and get creative and have fun doing what I love to do. So there might be some specials this week. I'm still throwing some stuff around.
Cool. Chris, what you got to plug?
Well, why you got to cut me off?
Yeah. I'm with Aaron on Driftwood. West Seattle in general, Driftwood, El Nido, I think Lady J, I think Tyler's doing an amazing job there.
Love Tyler.
Yeah. New Lactoid, the numbing beef at New Lactoid, one of my favorite dishes in all of Seattle. Lots going on there. And
personally, you got anything you want to plug? Like you said you're working on a movie, any books or articles, any fun stuff coming out?
Yeah, so the current issue of Seattle Magazine has a story. It's more about the arts. The previous issue, the January, February issue, we featured Kenji, Keiji Tsukasaki from limited edition sushi, and there was somebody else food related, but I can't. Yeah, related to limited edition. Also working on a feature on everything that's happening with Seattle's taking sushi to the next level, and I dare say that Seattle may be the best sushi city in the country.
You heard it here.
Better than San Francisco. Boom. Better than New York.
And what's the number one? Not worrying about price. What's your number one sushi spot in Seattle?
Limited edition special, that may be because it's the latest one that I've been to. Yeah. But you know, Taneda's spectacular.
Where is that?
Scratch. Limited edition. So it's on the backside of Callanderson Park.
It's a whole thing. Like you got to ring a bell and like know a password. Yeah. And
that's Suzuki. It's half in Madison.
Oh, that's a different. Okay.
Yeah. Also spectacular. Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. All right. Real quick. Remind us again what time the restaurant's open and how you make reservations.
So we're open Wednesday through Saturday. For the 10-course tasting menu, seating at 6:30. For the 4-course menu, seating at 7. You can go to our website sorrelseattle.com for reservations, or we're on Talk as our platform. For that, you know, it's Washington Wine Month. We do two big events in the month. Tuesday, March 26th, we have 10 wineries at the restaurant, all very niche in what they do, or part of the guard here in Seattle that does, or in Washington, that does amazing work, where we're showcasing them along with some bites and some fun things that we do at the restaurant. Limited attendance to keep it really intimate, so you have more time, and it's not like going that Costco style event. Not like that. It's very personal. You get time. But yeah, we'd love to see some folks come to the restaurant, and then Taste Washington this week will be a lot of fun.
Fuck yeah. Cool. Yeah, it is. I feel like it's Taste of Washington Wine Week, and it's like Seattle Cocktail Week. Like, same week. All right, some fun stuff. First of all, 420, April 20th, previous guest Max High from Sam Choi Poki. He's doing a really cool festival called the Foodie Fest at his restaurant that I'm blanking on. Oh, God. The Stonehouse Cafe. Stonehouse Cafe. So yeah, 420. It's like 4 p.m. till 10. I went to it last year, and like some vendors were sold out within 30 minutes. Like, it's a fun, cool festival. I love you, Max. Thanks for putting it on. This weekend, Kutu. So I never like to leave Ballard and Fremont with the cart, but like this week I'm going to be at Black Raven in Woodinville on Friday for the Men's Room, the KISR live show. So it's like a couple DJs, they're doing the Men's Room IPA release, so that's gonna be a huge event. So all you East Side people that keep on asking me when I'm coming to East Side, there you go. Saturday I'll be in West Seattle at Ounces from 3 to 8. So those are my plugs. I want to finish with two things. One, Aaron, it's funny, like I also started in front of house, back of house, into the same thing. When I forgot who messed, it might have been Denali. I forgot who messaged me and said I had to have you on, but
it was Harry from Eater.
That's who it is. Yeah. But me and you, very similar lives. Front of house, back of house. And then I also went to AI in Orange County. Then I staged at Mission Restaurant. And you know, now I do pop up dinners. And I also toured for many years. And so I'm fucking super stoked to meet you. I love what you're doing with the business model of like, I think working in, or I, you did a cool thing. I did Buffalo Wild Wings. Like I was a cook, then I was a server, and I saw, even though it was a shitty restaurant, I saw the value in like knowing both. And that's why I'm working on a project for this winter. I might be doing a thing at the Seattle Center for the Christmas market. And the people I'm working with, I said, first thing, you have to be able to do front of house and back house and prep and do every single thing, because people get sick, whatever, and it's gonna be a tight crew. And that was my first thing. It's like everyone has to be able to do everything. I love that attitude, because I as someone that served and cooked, like I have a lot of problems with the difference in pay. And so I applaud you for being able to put out a really good product, keep cooks happy, keep front of house happy, and find a system to do that. So I applaud you for your creativity. Chris, I don't know, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to talk about this, but I'm going to, and we can cut it out if you're mad at me. this summer you came and visited me at the market, and you're like, hey, I have a question for you. And you're like, hey, we're looking for like the most influential whatever in Seattle. And then I was like, oh, let me think of some people. You're like, oh no, we're considering you, but there's some other people. I'm like, oh shit. And then it just grew my brain, because I've wanted this for 10 years. Like, that is, I will never get best chef because I'm not a good cook. I'm not good at a lot of things, but I think I'm pretty good at putting on events and doing fun stuff. But you did mention like, it's like between you and Kenji. or not necessarily so many words, but like obviously Kenji got it, and that makes sense. And I wasn't bummed, because I was just honored that you even like thought of me. Like, I'm a fucking line. I was a line cook like 10 years ago, and I'm really appreciative of how far I've come, and I appreciate just even being recognized. However, something happened, I think after your thing, where Kenji posted something about being like 120 days sober, and
he thanked.
Andrew Zimmerman, fucking my favorite hero chef of all time, Gabriel Rucker from Le Pigeon, like fucking
and you
crush, and me, like, and so like, yeah, like, you know, I wasn't butthurt, but like, yeah, you know, I would have liked to, you know, got that, but the fact that I influenced the influencer is like, it was kind of a full circle moment. Felt really good. Thank you, Kenji, for the shout out.
Kenji was good to us.
Yeah, yeah. So thanks, Kenji. And thanks, Chris, for even considering me. All right, guys.
Sid, you know how, like, when you work in a kitchen, you get these little pet peeves?
Uh-oh. Say something nice.
I've been watching you wave that fucking Sharpie around. Put a cap on it, man. It's fucking dead.
I lost it early on. It's been
seeing a Sharpie without a cap on it and like not being used drives me fucking crazy.
I will tell you this much. I'll end it with this. Working in kitchens, especially like doing the tour catering where there's like a bunch of people and everyone's always asking for a Sharpie. You know, your first line is like, I came prepared for work today.
Like, Here's one. It's all dried up.
No. My rule, I'm going to end it this. If you are new in the kitchen and you're one of those dudes that always gets their Sharpie stolen, like, because like someone borrows it to use it in the
UR,
just give them the pen, keep the cap. Yep. You will 100% get your shit back. All
so
right,
who's
guys.
Got your cap?
I stole this from someone. All right, guys. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. Very fun episode. It was great meeting you, Aaron. All right, guys. Yeah, we'll
nice
see
you
next
you
time on
the
restaurant
podcast,
Seattle.
The Seattle restaurant
guys,
podcast.
We'll see you next time. Later.